This podcast is brought to you by Lanco Group, your business partner for engineering solutions. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
This time on the K-League United podcast, it's part two of our AFC Champions League group stage mini-series. 2018 Korean FA Cup winners Daegu FC's first foray into continental football will see the Sky Blues go toe-to-toe with some of Asia's footballing heavyweights. Accordingly, we speak to some of the region's top footballing experts to get the lowdown on the rest of the teams in Group F. For all this and much more, this is the latest episode of the K-League United podcast. Hello, I'm Ashim Nikar, Paul Neat here, your host for this week, operating as the lone striker as we look to tackle the group stages of the AFC Champions League. Last week, our own Matthew Binns guided us through Group G, and that podcast is still available for download either via your favourite podcast host or, of course, via kleagueunited.com. But this time, we shall be looking at Group F. Daegu FC enter Group F as the Korean FA Cup winners and are joined by Guangzhou Evergrande from the Chinese Super League, Melbourne Victory from A-League, as well as J-League's Sanfrecce Hiroshima. Over the next hour or so, we will hear from Ben Maxwell, the host of the J-Talk podcast, Asian football expert and co-host of the Asian Game podcast, Paul Williams, as well as South China Morning Post journalist Jonathan White, to discuss each team's lead up to the group stages, what has happened in the off-season, how the teams are likely to be set up tactically, as well as what would be a realistic target. But first, we are joined by our very own Myol Jung, K-League United's Daegu FC columnist.
Myol, how are you doing?
Hi, Paul. Yeah, I'm doing well.
The last time that we spoke on the podcast, we were looking ahead to the FA Cup final, the game, or games rather, that have changed it all for Daegu. Little did we know then that Daegu would be on the brink of winning their first piece of major silverware, and in the manner that they did, and are now about to embark on a historic AFC Champions League campaign.
Yeah, we are in ACA for the first time.
It's amazing. It's been quite a spectacular few months for the club, hasn't it?
Yeah, indeed, because no one has ever expected it could be in ACL.
Yeah, it's stuff that dreams are made of. As I alluded to, Daegu qualified for the AFC Champions League group stages as the result of that excellent FA Cup win. But that alone doesn't quite tell the whole story of Daegu's season. Could you please just give us a brief summary of 2018 for Daegu FC, please?
2018 season was the most memorable season Daegu FC have ever had, as Daegu signed off on a high note with FA Cup trophy. But to be honest, however, the first half of the season didn't go according to their plan, so Daegu only had to settle for one win from the first 14 rounds of the campaign. However, after World Cup break, they successfully bounced back with stunning performances. So during the second half of the season, they had a series of unbeaten run on several occasions in the league and finished the campaign in the seventh place. And the last winning FA Cup is grand final for Daegu.
Indeed. So for those that don't know, obviously people that may be listening that don't follow the K-League domestic season as much as we do, the FA Cup was over two legs, as has been the norm for the past two or three years now for the Korean FA Cup. And it was, I mean, the first leg went well. The second leg was just unbelievable.
Yeah, indeed. To read my preview of the second leg, I was very cautious to predict the result of the second leg, but they went beyond my expectation and finished 3-0 in the second leg.
Incredible.
It was such amazing. Yeah.
Incredible. What a way to sign off Daegu Stadium, the last ever game that we played there by Daegu FC. So it was quite a sign off. But since the final whistle was blown on that afternoon in at Daegu Stadium, after the cup final, what has been going on in the off-season?
I mean, just off-season, Daegu FC are having a very busy time in preparation for ACL competition, as well as moving to a new stadium, because Daegu FC are set to move to a brand new football stadium located in the center after 16 years of Daegu World Cup Stadium era. So the new stadium is now completed and being inspected for safety check and final rehearsal. So it is such a big changes in our setting. In terms of new signings, so Daegu mainly focused on bringing a few underrated or unknown player, but who have potentials rather than big names. And they also successfully kept their existing talent like Cezinha and Edgar and Joyanu. So it has been very busy off-season.
Sounds like it, yes. And how are you expecting Daegu to approach these AFC Champions League games tactically?
I took several hints from the formation they used for pre-season camp. And it seems like, you know, Daegu will stick to almost same formation and almost the same tactic, which was 3-4-3 formations with counter-attack with several young players and Cezinha and Edgar. So, I mean, in terms of approach ACL, I think Daegu will play very similar to last year.
I see. That sounds good because, you know, you wouldn't want them to miss this opportunity. They won't know when they're going to be in the ACL ever again. So it would be good, I think, to keep playing as they did towards the end of last season.
Yeah, the way they will play worked very well. So there's no reason to change.
So who would you highlight as Daegu's most important player? Someone that we should be keeping an eye on?
I think everybody is aware of how great and how wonderful Cezinha is, but this title needs to go Cezinha again because, you know, there's no doubt about his pivotal role in the pathway with the Daegu FC from the second division in 2016 to FA Cup winner in last year. And during the time, he keeps making such a phenomenal progress on the pitch year by year. And after the fantastic year in last year, I can't wait to see him on the pitch with better performances.
Yeah, he's a really important player, and he, you know, to get the amount of goals that he did last year and the amount of assists, not just in the league but in the FA Cup as well, it just shows how good of a player that he is.
Yeah, he proved his value in the squad.
He did. So finally, what do you think would be considered a successful ACL campaign for Daegu?
Before I move on, I have to admit, for small clubs like Daegu FC, the fact that we have got a chance to compete with giant clubs in the continental level itself is amazing and is a really huge achievement Daegu FC are very proud of. But once we qualify, we have to give out as much as we can. So I would say if mathematically Daegu FC hold on to the possibility of advancing to knockout stage until match day 6, even if they were eliminated in the end, but I think it can be said a successful campaign, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I think a lot of us are, just to see how Daegu do and to see how they do in that new stadium. So will you be there for the first ACL game at Daegu's new stadium?
Yeah, the first game is Melbourne away, so I don't think I can make it, but first the home game, I will be definitely there.
Excellent. All right, Miol, it's a pleasure as always. Thank you very much, and I'll speak to you soon.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you very much again to Miol. If you too would like to visit Daegu's beautiful new stadium, then you can check out the fixtures on kleagueunited.com, where you can also find Miol's Daegu FC 2019 season preview, which is out now. Join me after the break when we will be joined by South China Morning Post journalist Jonathan White.
FNR is a revolutionary football-dedicated digital platform, the first of its kind in Australia. It provides a 24/7 live online radio platform experience, podcast hub, and acts as a content provider for TV, radio, and digital. Having reached millions of listeners and football fans since launching 13 months ago, FNR is accessible worldwide via its website or app, providing a platform to discuss, debate, and celebrate the world game. We are your voice of football, FNR Football Nation Radio.
Hello, welcome back. I'm Paul Neat, your host this time on the K-League United podcast. Being deployed in somewhat of a free role this week, I have been talking about AFC Champions League Group F. And so from first-time entrants Daegu FC to two-times winners Guangzhou Evergrande, joining me on the line to discuss the CSL Giants from the South China Morning Post sports desk is journalist Jonathan White.
Hello, Jonathan. Thanks for chatting with us. How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, how are you?
Very good. Looking forward to the new season.
Absolutely, yeah. Can't wait for March. It's been a bit dead on the ground.
Yeah, it always seems to come around so fast, though.
Yeah, but also it drags on, and especially the problem with the Chinese Super League is that dead time is very much silly season, and that's either Western media getting too carried away with who's definitely going to China to some unnamed club who are apparently really rich, or with potentially players going overseas, which happened with Wu Lei, which was great, or with the latest rule changes, which are inevitable but never predictable.
Yeah, speaking of which, actually, I saw something on Twitter, I think it was, Guangzhou had put out something to do with the number of foreign players in its starting 11 down to just two players. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it seems to be true. That's the first thing. It also potentially has come out of nowhere, if you see this as, you know, a rule in and of itself rather than part of Evergrande's greater scheme, which has been on the record for quite some time, of having an all-Chinese starting 11, certainly, but ideally squad by 2020 has always been the time they've said, which would be at the end of this season coming up. It feels like a long way away, but it really isn't. So that has been something that's been on the cards for a little while, but no one thought it'd go like this. And then potentially what they're going to try and do is, because of the other new rule, which has come about very quickly, but with John Sohater and Nico Yanaris at Beijing Guoan, it's going to be more of this, which is naturalising players who have Chinese ancestry. And Evergrande have got a couple of those lined up. One of them, who's Ty Browning, who was at Everton, who was in the England youth setup. And the other one is Roberto Sucho, who I believe was once called up to a full Peru squad, but much like Elkerson, never actually got a game. So his international registration's up for grabs. So they could feasibly play Sucho as a foreigner, but they don't regard him as a foreigner. So they'll treat him as a Chinese player. Or the same could be said of Browning, but it appears that Browning will be their naturalised player.
Looking back to last season, Guangzhou, of course, have the most Chinese Super League titles, but last year they missed out. What can you tell us about their season?
So if we were having this conversation a year ago and we were going to look at the year ahead, it would have all been predictably rosy, as it had been for 7 years. They won their first title the year they came up. They won 7 on the spin. They're expected to win an 8th. They've long had the best Chinese players, which is the most important thing on one hand in the Chinese Super League because of your limits on foreigners. The better your Chinese players, the stronger chance you stand. And then the other side is they arguably had a couple of the best foreigners, really, because they've been around a while. Goulart, Allen started the season off great. He was absolutely brilliant. Then he got a ban for a bit of fisticuffs, so he was gone. And their season stuttered a little bit coming up to the massive midway break that included the World Cup. So Cannavaro, at one point, it looked like he was maybe going to end up the same way he did his first stint in Evergrande, which is where he didn't last a whole season. So they were struggling in the Chinese Super League because they weren't top. There was other teams doing the early running, among them SIPG, Beijing Guoan and Shandong Luneng, who were all giving them much more of a game. And for once, it wasn't just sort of one team going up against them, which has been what sort of made it easy for Evergrande. Apart from them being the best, or as their badge says, be the best forever. Yeah. Like, apart from that, like, they were only sort of going against one team in a title challenge. And last season, certainly the first half of the season, there was 2, 3, 4 teams in there. And that was a very different scenario for everyone. But they got to the midway break in and around the top. Then after that, like, they were still in the AFC Champions League. After that, well, after the World Cup, they got Paulinho back, who had been all right with Brazil and had been magnificent at Barcelona, certainly better than a lot of people had anticipated. So he'd answered a lot of his critics there and came back to China with a spring in his step, despite having played for about three seasons without a break. And they got Talisca in, and Talisca is just a magnificent footballer. So those two came into the team, and Evergrande's run from that point on when the league kicked back off was just astonishing. They made a real fist of going for an eighth title, retaining the title that they'd held for 7 years. It just so happened that SIPG were a little bit better. And the disappointment should be the first half, not the second half. Their other disappointment should be that they lost an absolutely bananas game of football at home to SIPG, which essentially decided the title, which was, you'd argue, uncharacteristic because they're used to beating people. But aside from that, SIPG and Evergrande have had some pretty bananas games, like they did in the 2017 Champions League over two legs. And then it was a similar story down at Tianhe last season in the second of the league meetings. And yeah, that essentially decided the title. So they came second. They'd got knocked out of the Asian continental tournament that they, you know, they've won twice, that they so often look like they are going to take seriously. They got knocked out of that in, what, the quarters, last 16. So it was a disappointing season for them, and one that now looks like it might be the start of a decline rather than a blip based on what's happened in the winter off-season.
Speaking of which, then what have they done personnel-wise in the off-season?
So the thing that seems to be going on is basically Evergrande have become, along with the new Tianjin team, which have replaced Tianjin Tuanjian after their sort of dramatic fall from grace in the pharmaceutical pyramid scheme industry, they pair of them, although these rumours have been denied, which make them seem more true, the pair of them seem to have become sort of de facto national teams, like an A and a B team. So between them, there's been a bit of trading around. Evergrande have also got rid of Allen, who, like I say, was a great player, certainly in the CSL. Ricardo Goulart has gone as well. They've kept hold of Paulinho and Tillis. They, post-Asian Cup, they dropped one of the players after his role in the defeat of China to Iran. He's now back in the first team squad. But this is sort of a hint at what's been going on anyway with the rest of this potential rule change they've brought in themselves, whereby they're going to have a smaller squad. They're going to have 24 instead of 31 players, like they're allowed. So the thinking is seven of them will be registered with the, well, they'll be registered as first team players, but play with the reserves regularly. Then every month, and this is perhaps the weirdest bit of it, every month they're going to grade the players, and two of them will drop down to the reserve team for a month. And then also they're going to change three players in the match day squad of 18 every single game. So unnecessary rotation, no opportunity to build on form. Who knows what's going to go on if all the players are playing well, or worse still, all of them are playing badly. It seems a pretty odd motivational tool, and one that you'd expect would mean that they're not going to be in the running for the title, bar some pretty special performances from Paulinho and Talisca and the likes of Gaolin and Zhengji, who are not getting any younger. And they haven't been for years, which has always been the criticism of Evergrande, that they got the best players such a long time ago. And, you know, they've all played in a national team together. They've all grown old together, but they're all the wrong side of 30. So we'll see. It's a work in progress.
I see. So obviously, historically, Guangzhou would usually be one of the favourites for the competition outright. This time, as you said, sounds like a lot of things had happened off the field as well as on it. How do you think they will set themselves up tactically?
Can't see their tactics changing, because they've been playing 4-2-3-1, essentially, under Cannavaro. But he took that over as a system. Their tactics have got to be the same. Like they used to being the best team in China. They used to having the ball. They used to, you know, using that possession to try and break down teams. Like they've got the speed of players to attack on the break if need be, but they're used to having the possession and playing the football. And you assume they're going to set out the same way, that this will be the same philosophy they've got. What might change is that they're not necessarily good enough to do this if they're changing players all the time and there's no rhythm between them. You know, if players are dropping in and out of the first team squad into the reserve team squad and they're not even training together, like that could mean that they're playing, how would you describe it? Disorganized, disjointed. not joined up football. And that would be where they'd get hurt. Because if you want to go out and play like you're a good football team, but you're not, then there are better teams in Asia. There's going to be better teams in China. And that'll be their undoing, I'd assume.
I see. Okay, well, who would you pinpoint as being the most important player for them?
If Anderson Talisca plays anything like he did last season, in his half a season, then I would expect him to be the Chinese Super League Golden Boot, whatever happens with Evergrande's run. Like, if even if they don't come, you know, top, second, say, heaven forbid they come third for once, he just looked amazing. He looked like he was playing a different game for his sort of 3-4 months there. He was scoring all sorts of goals. And if he can keep that up, if he decides not to drop down to the level that some of the rest of the players in the league are, like, he's a real talent. He's good enough to drag them certainly high up into the league and definitely out of the Champions League group stages.
I see. Okay, well, finally, what would you think would be considered a successful ACL campaign for the club?
I think right now, you know, they've long held ambitions of winning it. They've won it twice. That can't be the benchmark they've got to set themselves this season. They've got to get out the groups. They're good enough to get out the groups. The players there are good enough. Yes, they're getting older, but they're still good enough for a tournament that allows older players to shine in a way that maybe other sort of continental tournaments don't. So if they can match what they did last season, get out of the group stage, get into the knockouts, if they win one knockout game, if they win the second one, that would be a brilliant campaign. Maybe, you know, we've all got it wrong and this is some kind of masterstroke, these new rules that they've put in. And this is essentially like putting a national team into a club tournament and they'll do fine. I'd be very surprised by that myself.
That's it. It's certainly going to be interesting to see how it all works out for them, both in the ACL and obviously and domestically as well. All right, well, thank you very much, Jonathan. Just before you go, anyone who would like to read up on Chinese football and whatnot, where can they find you?
They can find me on the South China Morning Post.
All right, and what about any social media?
JMA White on Twitter.
All right, brilliant. All right, thank you very much.
Cheers.
Fans, we want to hear from you. You're encouraged to email KLU at info@kleagueunited.com or tweet at @KLeagueUnited with any questions, comments or reactions. Or follow us on Facebook to ask directly during one of our live shows.
Thank you very much again to Jonathan White. And now we move on to the next team in Group F, Melbourne Victory. And to talk all things Victory, we are joined by Asian football expert and journalist, not to mention the co-host of the Asian Game podcast, Paul Williams. All right, Paul, thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
I'm doing very well. It's good to join you.
So, talking about the Asian Champions League, now, unlike the K-League or the J-League or the Chinese Super League, the leagues which the rest of the teams from Group F will be representing, the A-League is already well and truly in full swing. How are Melbourne Victory looking so far domestically? Sitting second there, I see.
They are. They're a fair way now off Perth Glory, who sit top of the table. But they are. They've come through that. They're still in second. As I said, they're a fair way off Perth Glory now, who sit top of the table. After the weekend, they're now 9 points clear on top. So I don't think Victory can finish on top of the table. But of course, the way it works in the A-League, there's a final series at the end of that to determine the championship. So they won that last year from fourth position. So they look good to finish second this season. So they're still a threat to go through and do something with the season.
You touched on it there, back to last season. So what was the campaign like last year for Melbourne Victory? And through what means did they qualify for the AFC Champions League group stage?
Yeah, well, last year was a mixed year for Melbourne Victory. It was the season didn't start particularly well. It was an up and down season where they showed flashes of brilliance, but they were consistently inconsistent, if I can put it like that. That they could never get on a run and really cement their place. And it's the top six in the A-League that go on and make the finals, and they struggled to cement themselves at the top of the table. I think at the start of the season, they were 5, 6, 7 games without a win, and the pressure was piling on Kevin Muscat, their coach. Around the midpoint of the season, there was a flash point that happened in one of the games against Brisbane Roar, who were, again, not travelling all that well themselves. It was a home game in Melbourne, and they were 2-0 down at halftime, I think, And at that point, you know, there'd been some pressure building on Kevin Muscat, and every time his image flashed up on the screen, there was vociferous boos from the supporters. And yet not 2 or 3 months later, there was a vociferous cheers as he lifted the championship trophy. And they just managed to, and it can happen in a final series, they just managed to peak at the right time while they finished fourth on the table and were, you know, 20 odd points behind Sydney FC, who finished well clear on top. They hit the finals with some good form and some good momentum, and they faced a tricky trip up to Sydney in the semi-final. And after extra time, one of the most thrilling A-League matches you could possibly imagine, they got the job done, and they went to Newcastle, who had been one of the better teams. Cinderella's story had come from Wooden Spooners the season before to host the grand final. They went up there and got the job done. And courtesy of that, the way it works in Australia, if you finish on top of the table at the end of the regular season, you qualify for the Champions League. Whoever then wins the grand final also qualifies for the Champions League. And in that case, this was Melbourne Victory. So despite the fact they finished fourth on the table, they were crowned A-League champions. And as a result, they qualified for this year's Champions League.
The standout name to come in was Kosuke Honda. But what else has happened, and who else has come through the door?
A huge off-season for the club, and it was a big off-season, despite the fact they did win that championship. I think most fans recognise that they got a little bit lucky in doing so, and there did need to be a bit of an overhaul of the squad. It had effectively been the same squad for 2, 3, 4 seasons that had carried Victory through, and they'd started to get a little bit predictable. Players had started to wane a little bit. Players like Besart Berisha, who'd been an absolute legend of the club, had still managed to, you know, score 15, 16 goals in the campaign, but didn't have the impact that he once did. And they were able to move some players on and bring in some fresh blood. And they were able to sign, as you said, Kosuke Honda is the standout name there, superstar Japanese international, but Ulla Toivonen as well, the Swedish international, who also scored at the World Cup for Sweden against Germany. It's just a bigger signing as well. His impact on the team this season has been just as profound. His link-up play with Honda in the early part of the season before Honda picked up his injury showed real signs of an incredible partnership developing. And as Toivonen, who's been out injured recently as well, gets back to full fitness as the Champions League approaches, then that's it's a formidable opposition that teams will come up against when they play Melbourne Victory, when they've got Toivonen and Honda, two players who just 6 to 8 months ago were playing at the World Cup and now playing in the one team for Melbourne Victory in the Champions League.
Yeah, I saw that you were talking about Oliver Toivonen on Twitter and the impact that he's had. Is it him that you would pinpoint as the most important individual for Melbourne Victory, do you think?
I would, yeah. And I think I said that in the tweet that you were referencing there, that I think Ulla Toivonen is Victory's most important player. Doesn't necessarily mean he's their best player, but I think he's their most important player. When Kosuke Honda went down injured, James Troisi, who's, you know, an experienced Socceroos player, was able to step into the void. And while he doesn't have the quality that Honda has, the difference in quality isn't as vast as it is when Toivonen is out. The backup striker is a local lad by the name of Kenny Athieu, who's come out of the state leagues. And the drop in quality is quite significant when Toivonen misses and Athieu steps in. So for me, Ulla Toivonen is such an important part of this Victory setup. They look so much more threatening when he's on the field. He just makes things happen. His touch, without wanting to go all cliche, but his touch for a big man is just absolutely exquisite, and it allows it brings other players into the games. Whereas someone like Kenny Athieu may try the same thing, and his touches off, and the ball may go to the opposition or go wide of the mark. When Ulla Toivonen gets the same opportunity, his passes stick, and that then just sets up the next play. And that's why he's so important for Melbourne Victory, because he brings others into the game, not only with his play, but his runs and his movement off the ball as well. So Victory will certainly fancy themselves to get out of this group and perhaps go deeper into this competition. But for me, they can't do that if they don't have a fit Ulla Toivonen in their lineup.
I see. And how would you expect the team to set themselves up tactically for the group stages?
Victory are generally pretty consistent with the way they play. They always play a back four. You'll have a midfield three, or it can be you'll generally have maybe Calvaleri will be in there, Raul Baena, Spanish midfielder in there as well. They like to play with players out wide, Costa Barbarousis, is one that will play out on the right as well, and can play out on the right. This season has been deployed a little bit closer in with Ulla Toivonen and kind of going for that big man, small man formation. It's almost a classic 4-4-2, if you want to put it like that, but it's a midfield diamond as such. So you'll have Honda in midfield as well. James Troisi is in there. So they do play a 4-4-2 with a midfield diamond, but they do like to play wide. Their fullbacks like to push on Stormru on the right and Corey Brown on the left. They really like to get forward and join in the attacks. So, they generally play a 4-4-2. They like to play an attacking style of game, De Melbourne Victory. That's kind of their DNA that they've built over their 14 years of existence. They like to play attacking football. So generally, even when they're away from home, they will try to take the game to the opposition a little bit. While they might be slightly more pragmatic away from home, that is their modus operandi, that they don't really have the wherewithal to play a more defensive style of game, as we've seen from Australian teams in the past in the Champions League. So obviously, fans of Daegu who are listening to this, they can expect Melbourne Victory, especially when they play at home and they've got an impeccable record at home in the Champions League, to play a very attacking style of game, which can leave them slightly open at the back, which generally makes for very entertaining matches.
I see. So lastly, what do you think would be considered a successful ACL campaign or Melbourne Victory?
Yeah, firstly, that they have to get out of this group. I think given who they've drawn in this campaign, I think they'll be confident, given the players they've got in this squad, that they will be able to, that they'll be capable of getting out of this group. And they've only achieved that, I think, once in their existence before, and they got knocked out. I think it was by John Book in the round of 16. So certainly that'll be the first target to get out of the group. Remarkably, given this is, I think, Victory's seventh or eighth AFC Champions League campaign, they've never actually won a match on the road before. So that's surely a target for them as well, to actually get an away win in the Champions League. It's a remarkable record that they've played 15, 16, 17 matches away from home in the Champions League and not managed to register a single win in that time. So they'll certainly be the two targets for the group stage, to win a match away from home and also get out of the group stage. And if they get out of the group stage, then I think the crossover is with the group that contains Gyeongnam and JDT. And certainly given the inexperience of the teams in those groups, given a Champions League inexperience, certainly they would fancy themselves to progress then from the round of 16 as well. So I can see, if they can keep everyone fit and on the park, there's no reason that the Victory couldn't make a quarterfinal appearance in this Champions League. That should certainly be the target.
Sure. Okay. Well, one final thing for our listeners who would like to read your work and, of course, tune into the Asian Game podcast. Where can they find you?
Yeah, well, they can certainly look me up on Twitter. That is at @PaulWilliams_85, as you said, co-host of the Asian Game podcast with the great Scott McIntyre as well. So that's a fortnightly podcast where we cover everything to do with Asian football. But if you follow the podcast and you follow me on Twitter, I generally pop up in many different spots with different written articles and that. So I generally post links to all of those on Twitter. So if you just follow me on Twitter and follow the podcast, you'll keep across all my work.
Brilliant, Paul. Thank you very much.
Always a pleasure, and good luck to Daegu for their Champions League campaign as well.
Thank you very much again to Paul Williams. And so join us after this short break, when we will be looking at the final team to qualify for Group F, Sanfrecce Hiroshima.
Looking to spend some downtime with friends and fellow gamers in Seoul? Drop by Retro Game Bar. Located in Hongdae near Sangsu Station Exit 1, RGB is a retro game-inspired bar where you can play any and all types of games. Test their bartender's drink mixing capabilities or watch a game cast of your choosing. For those with a competitive side, sign up for monthly tournaments including Tekken, Mario Kart and K-League United's FIFA 19 competitions. Follow RGB on Facebook for tournament info and details on other events throughout the month. Mention that you're a fan of K-League United to their hard-working bartenders when you stop by for a starter shot to kick off the evening. Game on!
All Hello, welcome back. Paul Neat here, leading the line this week for K-League United. But without further ado, joining us to talk about Sanfrecce Hiroshima from J-League One is the host of J-Talk podcast, Ben Maxwell. Ben, thank you very much for joining us on the K-League United podcast.
How are you?
I'm great, thanks, Paul. It's good to be back for another season of firstly for us the J-League, but also the Asian Champions League getting going again. Very exciting times.
It is, just when winter is out the way and spring is around the corner, it's always good to get the football season back up and running.
Most definitely, yes. Can't wait for it to get going. Although, on a personal level, my team over here, FC Tokyo, their prospects for the new campaign don't fill me with a lot of optimism. But we're not here to talk about them because they did not make the Asian Champions League. So, let's move away from them as quickly as possible.
That's right. Yeah. So the J-League season has already kicked off. And as of March the 6th, so will the AFC Champions League. And Sanfrecce Hiroshima are back in the competition for the first time since 2016. K-League fans will know a bit about Sanfrecce because they played FC Seoul in 2014 and 2016, as well as Pohang Steelers in 2010 and 2013. But that was then, this is now. How did they get on domestically last season? How did they get to this stage?
Well, they almost stunned us all by winning J1 wire to wire. They certainly did not play the most attractive football at times, but especially before the World Cup break, they were very, very effective at simply winning games and winning ugly. Throughout the course of the second half of the season, their kind of magic act, the way they were somehow able to produce 3 points out of a seemingly ordinary performances out of seemingly nothing, that kind of dried up. And at the end of the day, they were simply swamped by Kawasaki Frontale. But they basically defied expectations all the way through the season, Paul, because in 2017, they narrowly escaped relegation. They brought in a retread manager who ironically used to manage my team, FC Tokyo, but he got nowhere near as good a result out of Tokyo as he did down in Hiroshima. He turned them from a 15th place team into runaway J1 leaders for, as I said, most of last season before they were eventually hauled in. What you're going to get out of them in the ACL this season, though, I think is very, very, very much up for debate. And I don't think you will get attractive, free-flowing football, which you didn't always get, admittedly, under their former manager who took them into the ACL in the previous seasons, Hajime Moriyasu, but who's now, of course, the Japan coach. But you might get a team that, as I said, is very comfortable with winning ugly. So that's something that Daegu might have to contend with in both legs of their meetings in the group stage.
So obviously it's been quite a comeback for them to nearly get relegated 1 year and then nearly win the league the following season. So it sounds like there've been quite a lot of changes off the field. What's happened in this off-season? What sort of changes personnel-wise?
Not a great deal, I think. They've had a couple of veterans retire, but they wouldn't have been major impact players in this tournament. They're going to rely heavily on the Brazilian striker Patrick again, and they might be able to Jovogu might be able to work away for Besart Berisha, who is ex Melbourne Victory, who came in midway through last season, but he just wasn't able to get a decent run in the team. He might be play a bigger role this season than he did in the second half of last season. But in terms of impact players in the transfer market, from what I've seen, they haven't done a massive amount.
Well, it sounds like then they have to rely on a lot of the squad that they've already got there in place. Is there any players in particular that we should be keeping an eye out for?
Patrick is the main man up front. He was their leading scorer last season. The captain, Toshihiro Aoyama, is their anchor in midfield. He's a veteran who was actually called up, to many people's surprise, for the Asian Cup. A lot of people thought that was because he was one of Moriyasu's most trusted lieutenants when Moriyasu was in charge of Sanfrecce. Elsewhere, there's Yoshifumi. Kashiwa is always an impactful wide player. It's a bit of a problem that Hiroshima have got. I think that they don't really have real impact players coming through. It doesn't appear through their youth system. And I think it's going to be a lot of the tried and trusted names from last year, who, of course, a lot of your listeners won't know because they didn't see Hiroshima in the Champions League last year. But yeah, I don't want to undersell them, but I'm fairly confident that you could see them prioritizing the J-League over the ACL, which is what, of course, a lot of J1 teams have done over the years. And Hiroshima are one of the most guilty parties in that regard as well. They've always prioritized the J1 games on a weekend rather than the ACL in midweek. I think we've seen what the J-League clubs can do in the past couple of years with the Urawa and Kashima winning it, obviously back-to-back. So when J1 teams do take things seriously, they can go a long way in the competition. But I don't think that will be a huge priority for Jofuku and Hiroshima this season.
I see. And we did touch on it a little bit earlier about tactically and their style of play, but you said they like to try and win games and they can get the job done without playing particularly attractive football. But tactically, what do you think we can expect?
Yeah, well, I guess it's, as we know, in a group stage setup like this, you want to win your home games and you want to take whatever you can get away from home. And away from home, that often means obviously sitting back and knowing that you're going to have to soak up pressure from an opponent who wants the ball and, you know, wants to come at you. But with Hiroshima, you might find that even in their home games, they will want to sit back and they won't mind the other team having the ball because they will want to, they'll want to counter. They'll want to play balls quickly over the top to Patrick or down the side to who I mentioned earlier, Yoshifumi Kashiwa, or even Kohei Shimizu, a fullback. So there's a lot of, I don't want to sound so negative about them, Paul, but I mean, they really, in some ways, are a very limited footballing side. They're happy to soak up pressure. And obviously, as I said earlier, it worked spectacularly well and stunned the entire league in the first half of last season. But it's not always the easiest on the eye. As I said, even at home where you would expect them to want to go on the front foot, oftentimes they simply don't want to do that.
I see. So finally then, what do you think would be considered a successful campaign for them?
Well, an ideal world, yeah, they would want to go far in the competition, I'm sure. But, at the end of the day, I don't want to speak for Jofuku, but if you gave him some truth serum, I think you would find out that this would not be his major priority. And it's always strange, you know, teams want to do well in the league to get into a position like this, and then in the past, Hiroshima haven't given it their full attention, which is a shame. So yeah, I mean, games of football, you go into them wanting to win, so they will want to get out of the group. I think it's a possibility with Daegu and Melbourne Victory. They're a decent chance to at least finish second. Obviously, Guangzhou are perennial powerhouses in this competition, but I would say it would be a decent three-way scrap for second in the group, and Hiroshima have a decent enough chance if they take it seriously. That's a huge if with them, though.
Sure. All right. Well, thank you very much. But first, for those who would like to tune into the J-Talk podcast and whatnot, where can they find you?
Yes, on Twitter, Paul, at JTalkPod. And we're on there's obviously a link to the website on my Twitter profile. If you're not a Twitter user, though, you can head to jtalkpod.podbean.com to find out latest episodes, or of course, subscribe through iTunes if that's your preferred way of getting podcasts. But very nice to speak to you. Thanks for the chance. And yeah, looking forward to the Champions League getting going.
Excellent. Thanks, Ben. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
Thank you very much again to Ben Maxwell, and indeed to all our guests this week, Myo Jung, Jonathan White, and Paul Williams. Now, we are into time added on here, but before the referee blows his whistle, let's take a little peek into the mailbag. And to assist with answering your questions, we have Ryan Walters, Matthew Binns, and Scott Whitelock.
We've had a question on email from Kim Gigi. He wants to know, why can't we just mix up East Asia and West Asia from the quarterfinals like we used to do in the past?
Yeah, it's
such a large continent, though.
Large continent and fixture congestion. If you look I mean, we can't just look at the K-League, but if we look at the K-League in just individually, we had 2-1 who were still in the FA Cup and in the Champions League, and the whole fixtures for the whole league last season were dependent on whether Suwon made it to the semi-finals or not. Mm-hmm. If Suwon made it through the semi-finals, rather, if Suwon made it to the final, all of the K-League fixtures would have been shifted. Now you expand that out to all the leagues in the tournament, and they've all got their own schedules and things. It gets a bit messy. I do like the idea, and I wish that it could be possible, like that perhaps at the semi-finals even, that we could start having East versus West. But I think from the quarterfinals, there's too many fixtures on the table for it to actually work.
I'd like to see different teams, but that just comes back to more Southeast Asian teams.
Sure.
That kind of thing. Now, just more variety than the big four, China, Japan, Korea,
I think,
and Australia.
I think that could be snuffed out at the group stage, because the groups are nearly, they're always predictable, the groups in Asian Champions League. I think
the allocations in the group, I think, need to be looked at for that. But I personally, I like the East versus West final. Like I like the rivalries that it builds within East Asian football from this perspective of things. Like I wish I could follow and knew a little bit more about West Asian football. But the thing of it is, here living in Korea, it's fun to keep up with the Japanese teams, the Chinese teams, the teams from Southeast Asia. And like we've started to see some actual like Champions League rivalries starting with these teams. And that's really fun. And I don't know that you would get that if it's this cross-continent competition earlier on. I think it would be more fair if it was East versus West early on. But I like the setup. I think it's kind of fun to have what's, you know, essentially the East Asian champion versus the West Asian champion, because it's such a large, vastly different continent that it's kind of a fun breakdown. And again, I like the rivalries that it creates. So I kind of like it the way it is.
I like it, but like I said earlier, I would like some more variety in teams. But that just goes back to how the groups were signed.
The groups need to be looked at, in my opinion.
Yeah,
I think there's no problem having it from the quarterfinals onwards. I mean, I've seen some people suggesting that the entire tournament should be open, but I mean, that's ridiculous from the group stage.
Travel logistics on that.
I don't think there's any reason why not to open it up from the quarterfinals. We're only talking about three stages of the tournament from that point.
So in summary, none of us agree.
Yeah, we all disagree.
Mainly just Scott's wrong.
Sorry.
Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen, but that is all the time that we have for this week. Join us next time when Scott Whitelock will be guiding us through Group E. In the meantime, don't forget to subscribe, and please feel free to leave us a review. We are on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Lisbon, TuneIn Radio, and we are on FNR Radio every Thursday, 3 p.m. Korea time, 5 p.m. Sydney time. We are also on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, all at K-League United, and of course, we are at kleagueunited.com. And so, until next time, thank you very much for tuning in.